Okay, today's bite of Torah is not particularly sponsored by any individual, but the series as a whole is sponsored by Jake and Karen Abelevitz in memory of Jake's parents, Eliyahu ben Abba and Leah Bas Avraham. What I'd like to do today is just start out with the very opening pasuk of Parshas Vayera. So let me share my screen with you. There we go. And if you have a chumash with you, then that's great. If not, then you can look along on the screen. And the opening pasuk of Vayera begins: Vayera elav Hashem be'elonei mamre, hu yoshev pesach ha'ohel kechom hayom. That Hashem appeared to Avraham, to him, meaning to Avraham, be'elonei mamre, in elonei mamre. Behu Yoshev, and he, Avraham, was sitting Pesach Ohel by the doorway of the tent, Kechom Hayom, in the heat of the day. Vayisa'ena Vayar, and Avraham raises his eyes and he sees Vinei Shloshan Hashim Nitzavim Alav. There are three individuals that are standing over him, Vayar, or close to him, Vayar, and he sees them, Vayaratz, and he runs towards them. Mipesach ha'ohel, from the opening the doorway of his tent, vayishtachu arza, and he bows to them. Vayomar, and he says, Adonai imnat matzasichein beinecha al nasa avor me'al avdecha. And now he speaks not to his guests or to the sojourners, but rather to Hashem, and he says, or vayomar Adonai imnat matzasichein. So the question is, who is this Adonai referring to? Is that referring to Hashem? Is he actually speaking to these individuals with an honorific? If it pleases you, please do not pass by. Let some water be brought to you. Rest your feet, wash your feet, rest yourselves, and rest underneath the tree. And let me get some bread for you, and you will eat. For you have passed by my way. And he refers to himself in a very humble way by referring to himself as an eved of his guests. And they say, do as you have said. We're down. We're good with the plan. And Avraham runs to the tent to Sarah, Vayomer, and he says, Maharish Losh Sim Kemach Solis Lushi Vasiu Goat. He says, go and prepare three sa'az of flour and rustle up some bake some bread for these guests. Bela Bakarat's Avraham, and Avraham runs to the Bakar, to the cattle. And he takes a choice animal and he brings it to the lad, and the lad quickly prepares it. And Avraham brings some bread and some milk and the young calf that he had prepared, and he brings it to his guests. And he is waiting upon them under the tree, and they eat. Okay. So I want to take a look at these first opening eight psukim of the parsha. So these psukim are the introduction to the dialogue and the events that occurred with Avram the Malachim, Lot, and Stone. And the question is, what is the significance of this opening story? So, again, just to summarize here for a second, these eight psukim, you can see a little better here just in the Hebrew, Avraham, Hashem appears to Avraham, where did we go? Sorry, when I changed it into the Hebrew, I lost the place. Here we go. Hashem appears to Avraham. Avraham sees the guests. He takes time to prepare for his guests. And then he feeds his guests and he gives them what they need, and with that, those are the first eight psukim. And then Vayomrei la Vayesar Ishtacha, they say, where is your Where's your wife? And, you know, the whole story with Lot and Sodom and the promise of a children. All these things, the dialogue that happens with the Malachim begin. So let's start with these eight psukim, with the first of the eight psukim. Vayera elav Hashem. Hashem appears to Avraham be'elonei mamre, hu yoshev pesach okachom hayom. So if I would ask you to, with this opening pasuk, is there anything, again, the Torah always operates with an economy of language. So is there anything in this pasuk that you think might not be sort of necessary just to get the point across that Hashem appeared to Avraham? In other words, is there anything in this pasuk that you could delete? And if you deleted it, the story would still be fine. Avraham meets the angels. They he gives them stuff. They promise him, you know.
Both where it took place apparently is necessary, but doesn't seem necessary on the surface. And also where he was sitting.
Okay, good. So the pasuk says that Hashem appears to Avraham be'elonei Mamre, amongst the trees of Mamre. Now, the question is, why is that significant? I mean, the story would still go on just as fine, even if we didn't know that he was in Elonei Mamre. The truth of the matter is, I think we already know earlier where he is, if we go back to where he, well, whatever. Whether we know it or not, the fact of the matter is, Hashem appears to Avraham. Even without knowing Elonei Mamre, the story would be just fine. V'hu yoshev pesach ha'ohel. And fact number two in this pasuk, which seems to be first glance unnecessary, v'hu yoshev pesach ha'ohel, he was sitting in the entrance of his tent. Right. So why is that significant? And then number three, kichom hayom, it's the middle of the day. Right. So each one of these demands some attention. Let's start with Hashem appearing to Abraham in Elonei Mamre. So just to point out that this is significant, even without understanding the content of why it's significant, if we look at these first eight psukim as a unit, right, it's the introduction to everything. So in Pasuk 8, Vayikach Chema V'chalav U'ben HaMakar Asher Asa, Avraham brings the food that he prepared, Vayitein Lefneim, V'hu Omed Aleihem Tachat Ha'etz. And he is standing, and waiting upon them underneath the tree. Okay. Similarly, so that's the first pasuk of this unit and the last pasuk. So it creates already a literary bookend, bookends over here. Okay, but it's not just the literary bookends, pasuk aleph and pasuk ches. But if you look at the middle over here, pasuk dalet, pasuk number four. He says, if I find favor in your eyes, don't leave me, stick around. Pasuk number four, yukach nama mayim, have a little water, v'rechatzur aglechem, and wash your feet, v'hishanu tachat ha'etz, and rest under the tree. Okay, so we have Elonei Mamre, the trees of Mamre, at the beginning of the section. In the middle, that the visitors should rest underneath this tree. And at the end, Pasuk Ches, he tells them, and he's waiting upon them, Hu Omed Aleihem, like a servant waiting his master, Tachas Ha'etz, underneath this tree. So what is the significance of the presence of the tree is no longer just if it ever was just about giving us a location, it is clearly no longer just about location. Because even if you could argue, well, it's important for us to know that he was under the trees of Mamre, it's not so, it would seem less important for us than to tell us that, he told them to go to rest underneath the tree and he was waiting upon them underneath the tree. So the presence of the tree must have some significance here. Okay, so the question is, what is the significance of the tree? Okay, let's go on a little further. V'hu yoshev pesach. I'm sorry.
I think that.
But one second, before we take ideas on this, I want to go a little further and just point out. V'hu yoshev pesach ha'ohel k'chom hayom. Now, where is he situated? So Hashem meets him, you know, in Elone Mamre, in these trees. V'hu yoshev pesach ha'ohel k'chom hayom. And he is sitting at the entrance of the tent. And he wasn't sitting under a tree. He was generally under the trees of Mamre, but he was at the the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. So why is this significant? So on one level, it might be significant to tell us that you had these wayfarers, these sojourners that were coming by in the heat of the day, and he was taking care of them. Okay, so let's start with the Elone Mamre piece. Okay, so if you look on the side of your page, on the screen, so Rashi tells us. Whoops, where is Rashi? There we go. Rashi tells us Elone Mamre is significant. Why? Not so much for the trees, but because these are the trees of Mamre, right over here. Who Mamre, who shenatan lo etza al hamila? Mamre, according to the Midrash, was a friend, he was a friend of Avram, and according to the Midrash, Avram sought counsel with Mamre. When Hashem told him that you should have a bris mila, so apparently Avram went ahead and consulted with Mamre and basically said to him, you think this is a good idea or not? And Mamre said, and according to the Midrash, he consulted with several friends. Mamre is the one who said, go ahead, do it, make it happen. Lafikach, therefore, Rashi says, Nigla alav bechelko, this amazing, miraculous event that occurred to Avraham happened in Mamre, apparently as a signal of divine blessing to Mamre, because Mamre was the one who supported Avraham in his decision to do a bris mila, and so it was a divine blessing. When the king shows up, when the celebrity shows up to your house, it's a great honor. So Hashem shows up to the house of Mamre, as it were, Elone Mamre, and this is a great honor. Okay, now. If this is so, then you have to ask yourself the question, right? So Elonei Mamre is significant because Avraham was debating whether to have a bris mila or not. And this is, pretty striking. So how is it possible that he was at all debating Hashem? I mean, Hashem said, Lech lecha, me'artzecha, me'moladetcha. That was no problem. He was willing to go on a trek from Haran to his homeland to Eretz Canaan. No problem. He was willing to leave his family, to leave his homeland, to leave his fathers, to leave everything. No problem. Now Hashem tells him to do a bris mila. So now he doesn't have emuna. So you could say, okay, like everybody has their limits. It's one thing you want to tell me to move. It's another thing you want to tell me to have a bris mila. That's a minor surgery, right? I'm willing to fight the elements. I'm not willing to cause self harm. So maybe that was going through Avram's mind. So what was going through Avram's mind when he apparently debated this and sought counsel from Mamre? So. Has anybody heard any answers to this question before I share with you what I want to share with you? If you do, you can...
I have an answer.
Okay, go ahead.
Briefly. The answer doesn't come from me. It comes from a Kiruv group that someone else who speaks was talking about.
Okay, go ahead.
Said that he was 99 when he had the bris mila. So we're not talking about like some youngster getting a bris mila or even a 20-year-old.
Yeah.
So he might have questioned in his own mind, what's the story with the 99-year-old? Should I be doing this kind of a thing?
Okay.
How old I am,
All right, I hear that. I hear that, you know, maybe.
We take for granted all these things that Avram went through, but people with fresh eyes who don't see this all the time look at these things and say, wow, you know, I can get over that he did these things. And Akedas Yitzchak, we know the beginning and the end. But
okay.
Guess what? Not everyone does. And they read it and they say, you know, wow, you know, like what went through his mind then, you know?
Okay.
So.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So I think that that if I had to, you know, think about this, it would seem to me that it should be maybe not a no-brainer, you know, maybe a no-brainer for Avraham, given everything that that happened to him thus, you know, thus far, and as far as he had come, but maybe not. Maybe, you know, maybe Avraham's just like every person, as I said, and he has his, you know, he had his limits. Let me share with you what something that Rav Moshe Feinstein understood this. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says the following. We may say that Avram's question to Mamre was not, chas v'chalila, should I or should I not do Dvar Hashem? That's no question. You know, to suggest that Avraham, says Rav Moshe, to suggest that Avraham was actually, at this point in his life's journey, debating whether he should listen to Dvar Hashem, you know, strains credulity. However, what was Avraham going through, and what was he debating with, or seeking advice from Mamre? So says Rav Moshe, Avraham thought it might be better to do it privately. Not whether to do it at all, but maybe it's better to do it privately. Why? Because were it to become generally known that he had performed such a seemingly dangerous and irrational act, it would undermine his whole message that he had been preaching for years, that Hashem's ways are rational, they're agreeable, they're not barbaric pagan practices that prevailed at the time. But this is, you know, and therefore he was concerned that doing the Dvar Hashem might undermine his ability to spread Dvar Hashem. So fearful that those who he had brought into the divine tent, as it were, would either abandon him or it would hamper his ability to spread it any further. So he thought, you know, and this is what he consulted with Mamre. Not unreasonably, says Rav Moshe, Avraham was worried that he might lose a large portion of those who he had worked so diligently with to bring him under the wings of the divine presence, right? Even if Avraham was totally on board, you know, maybe this was too much for other people to handle. Nevertheless, what was Mamre's advice? Mamre's advice for him was not to conceal the fact that he did a bris milah. And meaning that once Hashem gives a mitzvah, we just do it. And we shouldn't think too deeply about its rationale, its consequences. If we believe in Hashem and we believe in his mitzvahs, then we have to feel sort of confident and strong that they can stand on their own. And you don't have to hide Hashem in order to spread in order to influence people with the message of Hashem. It's a little corrupt actually to do it that way. It's like a bait and switch. You know, now it doesn't mean that the very first thing you have to tell somebody is bris milah. You know, that maybe that's not the first thing. Like I often say, if somebody told me, Rabbi, I have one time a year that I can come to shul, when should it be? I wouldn't say Yom Kippur. I would say Purim, right? Okay, because you know, Yom Kippur might be too harsh of an experience for a first time participant. It doesn't mean that I hide Yom Kippur. That doesn't mean that I pretend that Yom Kippur doesn't exist. Tell you, no, really, you can eat. It's okay. No. So Mamre's advice here was that, and I think the message here is, that simply doing a mitzvah for the sake of fulfilling Hashem's will has a greater impact on the world than any number of reasons or explanations. At the end of the day, The mitzvah stands on its own. And the truth of the divine spark will either impact or won't impact, but it only has the chance of impacting if it is if the mitzvah is performed, if the mitzvah is done, if the mitzvah is expressed. To do otherwise is sort of a bait and switch. It's not, you know, it's not honest kirov, if you want to say that. So, and I think there's a broader message here, which is relevant. And that is that I think that for some of us, and sometimes for some of us, we feel that a mitzvah may not resonate with how we look at life, or maybe a mitzvah doesn't resonate with current moral conditions, and I think that the point here of Avraham, that the Medrash is making with Avraham's getting this advice from Amre, is that we shouldn't be afraid. We shouldn't be afraid, to do what is right. We shouldn't be afraid to do a mitzvah because of the impact that it might have. Now, there are different types of ways of performing mitzvahs. There's having a minion on a plane, which, you're standing on other people and encroaching in their space. So maybe that is, that's doing a mitzvah at somebody else's expense. Okay, so now you have to ask a question. Maybe it's appropriate, maybe it's not appropriate to do this mitzvah. But to be afraid to do a mitzvah because it looks weird to other people, that shouldn't be a consideration. So, going back to my airport example, or airplane example, if you want to have a minion on an airplane that's going to, cause grief to other people, that's one thing, right? But if you want to, sit in your seat and daven in your seat, or if you wear tefillin to stand in an airport and wear tefillin in an airport, it's not bothering anybody, it's not doing anything to anybody, it just, you feel self-conscious about it, so I think that the message here of Mamre to Avraham is, don't feel self-conscious about it. That we should feel strong and confident in Dvar Hashem. And I think that it's interesting that this advice comes from it comes from Mamre, who was not a Jew. Mamre, who was not, in Avraham's circle of in his tent, as it were. And sometimes, you need to hear it from somebody outside the group, sort of, let you know that it's, that it's okay. But that's how Rashi, deals with it. Rashi says it's not the Elonei that's important here. It's not the fact that they're trees, but it's that the tree, we're in the Elonei Mamre. And Mamre is what is significant. So once we're talking about the place of Mamre, it is the Elonei Mamre. But it's not the Elon that's important, it's the Mamre that it's important. But I would suggest that there's still that it's not just a Mamre. There still is something about the tree. The tree comes up at the beginning of this introduction, the middle of this introduction, and the end of this introduction. And here, I want to. Does anybody have a suggestion that they would like to share before I tell you what I have on my mind? Okay. All right. So I want to share with you something that this is not a mafarash, it's not a medrash, but let me share with you my screen. This is an article. There's an article which was in Haaretz online some time ago. I don't know exactly. Let's see, what's the date on this thing? Does it even say what the date is? I can't see it. I don't even know if this has a date. Okay, whenever it was published, it was published. Okay, so if we look in, I'll come back to this in one second. Right, so let's, on your screen you have our pasuk. I'm going to put an English translation alongside the words here. Okay. And when we do the English, it's, there we go. And here we are. Okay. Vayera elav Hashem be'elonei mamre. Hashem appeared to Avram in Elonei Mamre, which is translated here as the terebinths of Mamre. Terebinths of Mamre. So what is exactly is a terebinth? So a terebinth is apparently some kind of tree. And to learn more about the terebinths, let's go back to this article here. So the terebinth, apparently, is the Atlantic pistachio tree. The Atlantic pistachio tree, I don't think they called it the Atlantic pistachio in the time of Mamre, but in the modern, what's it called, scientific, designation, it's known as the Atlantic pistachio. So in Israel, fall doesn't trumpet its arrival in the cacophonous changing of leaves. A rare one whose leaves do turn russet in the best tradition of more northern climes is the wild terebinth, also known as the Atlantic pistachio. Oft mentioned in the Bible and a source of superfood for the locals wherever they were human. So the first thing you have to know about the terebinth is that it changes colors in the winter, in the fall. Like a lot of trees, evergreens and a lot of other trees, or some other trees, they are pretty much the same all year round. But the terebinth is in Israel is a rare one whose leaves actually do turn color. Right? In America, in the Northeast, we have fall foliage; it's all over the place. But in Israel, this is something which is rather rare. Point number one. Next. Some terebinths are low and bushy, like in the Valley of Elah, where David fought Goliath. Okay, so point number two is that the Alon or the Elah comes up in some interesting places in Tanakh. For example, it's present where David with a fight of David and Goliath. Okay. Fight of David and Goliath. So some of them are low and bushy, yet others have broad girths and wide crowns in the rare places where deforestation over the centuries was avoided. Okay, we'll leave off the politics there. Okay, the Pistacia Atlantica nuts, among the choice fruits of Canaan that Yaakov instructed his sons to take back to Egypt. So if you recall, when Yaakov and a few Parshias, Yaakov, there's a famine in Israel, and he sends the boys down to Egypt to go get food, right? And they go, and then they come back, and he tells them to the whole thing with Yosef, and part of it. Let's take a look at the pasuk. Part of it here. Let's go back a couple of pasukim. Vayomer Yehuda al Yisrael. Yehuda says to his father Yaakov, Shilcha hanari tivan akuma v'neilecha, send the boy Binyamin with me. We'll go down to Mitzrayim so we can live and we won't die. Gam anachnu gam tapenu. So, we'll have food for the family to live. Anochi arvenu, and I know you're concerned about Binyamin. I will be responsible for them. I will be the what's it called? I can never remember this word. Yeah, when you mortgage your house, so your house becomes the when you loan something to somebody and they give you something to hold, what's that word?
Security.
Yeah, there's another.
Guarantor.
There's another. Guarantor. One. What's the item called?
Like a guarantor.
What's the item security called?
Security.
A
guarantor.
No. Okay.
Isn't it a guarantor?
Guarantor is a person.
A collateral.
What?
Collateral.
Collateral, thank you. Okay, so I will be, I'll be the guarantor, and my body is the collateral, Okay, And if not, you know, I will be, you know, I will, whatever he says. That's for the story of Yosef. You know, Kilule hitmamanu, for we could have been there and back twice if we had not dawdled. Kiata shavnu zeh pamayim. But you know, Yaakov didn't want to send Binyamin down. Vayomer aleihem Yisrael avihem. Yaakov says to the children, Im kein efozosasu, if we're already going to go this way, this is what I want you to do. Krum yizimras haaretz bekleichem, take from some of the you know, choice products of the land, v'horidu le'ish mincha, and bring that man, meaning Yosef, he doesn't know it's Yosef, bring him some gifts, so that way, you know, we can get what you need, and we can bring, and we can make sure that everything happens well, and blah, 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 etc. Right? So, what is he going to bring? Ma'at tzari, u'ma'at devash, necha'os valot, botni mushkeidim. Going to bring some balm and some honey, some gum, some landanum, botnim ushkedim, nuts and almonds. So what are botnim? So take a look at the right side of your page here. Rashi says, what are botnim? Whoops. What are botnim? Look on the right side. Lo yadati mahem. I don't know exactly what botnim are, but uperushe. Aleph Beis Shel Rabbi Bat Machir. If you look in the commentary of Rabbi Machir, Ra'iti, I saw that these botnim, these nuts, are pashtitzias, pistachios. Right? They come from the terebinth, from the Atlantic pistachio. Vidom Eli, but Rashi says, I think Shehema Farsikin. I think that these botnim are peaches. Okay. But at least Rabbeinu Machir thought that they were these terebinth, you know, they come from the terebinth tree, these pistachio trees. So so let's go back here to our article. So we have here the terebinth, number one. Its leaves change in the fall. Number two, it's present at some significant moments of Jewish history. David and Goliath. Or for example, when Yaakov sends the boys down to Mitzrayim. Okay? And just two of several examples. Right? And then of course, right here, Elon Moreh, is the place in which the, you know, Avraham does his bris milah. That's a significant moment in Jewish history. So the presence of this tree seems to be not just by accident, but it indicates it shows up. I would say it shows up in significant transitional moments in Jewish history. Right, the Battle of David and Goliath, that was a significant moment. It's the moment probably in which Shaul decides that he's going to spend the rest of his life chasing after David and trying to kill him. This is when there begins to be this shift, significant shift in the way Shaul thinks about David. Shaul thus ultimately loses his own melucha. He spends his whole life chasing after, Moby Dick, chasing after this, the whale, and the whale ultimately, and that chase ultimately consumes him, right? Yaakov and Mitzrayim, that's a transitional moment, and the Bris Milah, when Avraham makes his mark on his body as a covenant of Hashem and Avraham and his followers, this is a significant moment of transition in the history of the Jewish people. Okay, so number one, changes in fall, as opposed to most other trees in Israel. Number two, it shows up at moments of transition in the history of the people. Then there's the grisly tale of the death of Avshalom, son of David. Bible says it was from the bows of a great terebinth that Avshalom found himself caught by his famously heavy tresses when his father's general, Yoav ben Tzruya, found him and ran him through. So Avshalom, who was trying to, you know, who was rebelling or against his father, he ultimately sees his demise. His hair gets caught up in the terebinth tree, right? So even here, it's an interesting to think about. Here, this is this great moment of flux, and Avshalom gets caught up in this tree that represents, you know, transition and flux, right? So, okay, take a look. This is a picture of a big terebinth, the type that Avshalom's hair could have got caught up in, or the type that the angels might have been resting under, or the type that Avram Avinu might have seen when he did his bris milah and he was resting up in Elonei Mamre. All right, Atlantic pistachio seeds were unearthed in an excavation going back some 9,000 years in Jarmo in northeastern Iraq, near the oil-rich, dispute-steeped region of Kirkuk. These seeds were also among seven types of edible nuts found, along with stone tools to crack them open, at Gesher Benot Yaakov, near the banks of the Jordan River, where our prehistoric ancestors ate them some 780,000 years ago. All right, that we'll leave for another time to discuss time and dating of the world. Over the ages, the Atlantic pistachio has found many uses. The fruit produced oil used for lighting and medicine, and the wood was carved into olive presses and other agricultural devices. So apparently, point number three is that the terebinth tree who was the author of that poem, The Giving Tree? Anybody remember? Right? It was the first giving tree. Right?
Paul Silverstein.
Right, so thank you, Marabina. Right? The giving tree. The giving tree. So this is the first giving tree, the Elonei Mamre, the Emek Elah, the tree that produced produced fruit, produced oil for lighting and medicine, and its wood was carved into olive presses, which was a major commerce of the day, and other agricultural devices. So the Alon represents Chesed. Okay, so let's go back here. We have it changes in the fall. It's present at major transitional moments in Jewish history. It is the first giving tree. Then, apparently, God is in the terebinth tree. Literally, the Hebrew name for the tree Elah, or Alon, is derived from the word El, which means Hashem, Kael, which is God. The feminine form of that word is Elah, which means goddess. The tree's ancient name is evidence of the pagan devotion to trees, right? There were trees that were used for avodah zarah, like the Asherah tree, right? That's a very famous tree that was right. So going back far at least to the Canaanite times, and of the pistachio's association with the goddess worship that the Bible frequently mentions, and you can see that pasuk in Yirmiyahu, the sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron and with a point of a diamond. It is graven upon the table of their heart and upon the horns of your altars, whilst their children remember their altars and their groves by the green trees upon the high hills. All right, so I don't know how good of a proof that is, but nevertheless. Old large terebinths apparently survived the deforestation in the Holy Land from Roman to Ottoman times because people believed them to be sacred and brought them their prayers and petitions. In fact, some people still do, as seen by colorful pieces of cloth or even plastic bags tied to such trees to this day. That I don't know anything about. I'm just reading you what they say. Next. So if this is true, that in ancient times, the Elah or the Alon was revered by pagans as somehow sacred. So this would be, I think, a very, you know, very interesting as well. And finally, and this I think is maybe the biggest point that I want to focus on, but I think all of them together create something interesting. Not only is the pistachio considered sacred by some, it has a unique symbiotic relationship with a certain kind of aphid. It's a tiny bug that when you buy lettuce, you're supposed to make sure that the lettuce is washed. Strawberries, because they have these aphids in them. But going back to our point, in the spring, the trees sprout fist-sized growths called galls. But they're not some seasonal tree tumor. The galls are formed by the aphids. Okay? These little creatures create an incubator out of the leaves, apparently only of this particular tree. Their young are nourished by nutrients in the leaves and eventually emerge fat and happy from an opening in the gall. So apparently, this tree, which is a unique tree in Israel because it changes in the fall, it's present for everything we spoke about, but it has this uniqueness that it has these aphids which are born in the tree. You know, they lay their eggs and they're born in the tree, in the leaves, and they destroy the leaves in the process. Okay? At least, so galls, this is the writer, of the author speaking now, galls are bad. At least that's what the goats apparently tell each other when they come to feed on the Atlantic pistachio tree, because apparently these galls emit a bad odor. In fact, chemical analysis showed that they emit quantities of the stinky organic compound called terpenes. I think they make turpentine from the tree. Scientists observing foraging goats report that animals turned up their noses at the Atlantic pistachio and went on to seek something less odoriferous for lunch. Thus, the lowly aphids protect the tree from overgrazing. Research has also shown that the galls even release antibacterial and antifungal agents that also protect the tree.
Yeah.
Thus, what seems to be puncturing and deforming the leaves of the terebinth actually defend the trees and help them thrive from season to season, century to century, if no one cuts them down. Okay, so we have, I think, sort of five interesting points here about the Alon, the Elah, the terebinth tree. Number one is that it is somewhat unique in Israel in that its leaves change colors in the fall. It represents the notion of transition and transformation. This tree is present in Jewish history at some significant turning points, significant transitional moments, like the Bris Milah of Avraham, like Yaakov sending the pistachio nuts down to Mitzrayim, according to Rabbeinu Machir, cited in Rashi, even though Rashi thinks they were peaches. Right? David and Goliath, this is a transitional moment in the personal history between David and Shaul, but also sets the groundwork for some terrible history to come, which will be the fall of Shaul and the rise ultimately of David. Number three, this type of tree is the original giving tree, right? It has fruits, it's oils, its wood was used for all types of things. It was considered very nutritious. It was even considered sacred during pagan, to the pagan Canaanites. And finally, it's unique in that these aphids grow and lay their eggs and seem to destroy. They are terribly harmful and destructive to the trees, but in actuality, even though they seem to be destructive, they are in fact protecting the trees in multiple ways. Number one is that they let off an odor which keeps the animals from overgrazing them, as well as you saw in the article, I don't know, some bacteria and fungus, you know, which keeps other animals away altogether, and so what seems to be some type of destructive behavior actually has the great benefit of protection. Okay, so how does this all lead us back to the question which we posed at the beginning? What is the significance of the Elonema, of the presence of this tree at the beginning of this introduction, the middle of this introduction, and the end of this introduction. So let's go back now and read these psukim with this information in mind. Okay. Hold on one second. Yeah, just to take a look over here on the side of your page, the Ramban, and then we're going to read these psukim again with our new data in mind. So the Ramban says the following: Elonei Mamre, Lahodia Hamakom Asher Bo Nimol. Why does it tell us Elonei Mamre? Because it's important for us to know the place where Avraham had his bris. And this is a representation of Hashem's presence and a great honor. Just like we see in the Mishkan. I'm going to, what this I think is in English? We can read it in English. Hold on a second. Maybe the Hebrew is easier. That seems like a lot of English there. If I can find it, otherwise we'll go back to the Hebrew. We'll just do it in the Hebrew. All right. Try one more. If not,
Rabbi, what's interesting?
One second.
Tremendous mitzvahs that come from this area of the street.
Yeah.
He does the first milah, and then he's doing Hakhnasas Artem. Right.
Yes.
And they're all happening with this tree, this kind of a tree.
Yes.
So there's this significant.
Okay. Here we go. In the Oaks of Mamre. All right, or the Terebinths of Mamre. Okay, so this is to inform us of the place where he was circumcised. Now, this revelation of the Shekhinah came to Avraham as a mark of distinction and an honor, even as that is said in connection with the dedication of the Mishkan. Right, was an account of their effort in fulfilling the commandment of building the Mishkan that they merited seeing the Shekhinah. Similarly, Avraham merits seeing the Shekhinah in the merit of this great mitzvah. Now the revelation of the Shekhinah here, and there was not at all for the purpose of charging them with some commandment or to impart some communication. No, it wasn't about coming to communicate or to tell them to do something. It was simply a sign of warmth, of love. You did this great thing for me. I am going to be with you. Instead, it was a reward for the commandment which had already been performed, and it informed them that their deeds have God's approval. Even as it says, as for me, I shall behold the face of righteousness. Similarly, in connection with Yaakov, it says, and the angels of Yaakov met him, and yet we find no communication there. When Hashem is communing with Avram here or Yaakov there, it's not about giving a mitzvah or a communication or informing. Instead, the verse only informs us that he merited seeing the angels, and thus he knew that his deeds had his approval. This is a way of Hashem showing his love and warmth by being with Avraham. And so it was with Avraham. The seeing of the Shekhinah was both merit and assurance of God's approval. Similarly, the sages passed through the Red Sea. A handmaid saw at the sea what Yechezkel never saw. This they merited at the time of the great miracle. So Hashem's presence. Okay, so my point here is that the Ramban says that it tells us where... It tells us Elonei Mamre simply for the purposes of telling us where this happened, because where Hashem appears is a sign of great love and distinction and honor and respect. Okay, but now let's read these psukim in light of what we saw about the terebinth tree. Vayera lav Hashem be'Elonei Mamre. God appears to Avram in Elonei Mamre, and he is sitting in the tent kechom hayom. Now he's sitting at the entrance of the tent. The Medrash tells us because he's looking for guests, right? He wants to do a mitzvah, as as Barbara said, kichom hayom, in the heat of the day, that even though it was the heat of the day, and it was clearly difficult for him, nevertheless, he was putting him out. He was putting himself out there to do chesed. So Elonei Mamre represents transition, right? Which is the mitzvah that Avraham had just done and for which he is now recuperating, right? And it also represents a significant moment of transition in the history of our people. And this is not just a personal transition for him, a personal change, but this is a significant moment for Klal Yisrael. It represents chesed. And what and why is this tree here? Because this is Avraham is Chesed. He's sitting Pesach Ha'Oel Kechom Hayom. Right? These three facts are all reinforcing one another in that they are reinforcing the fact that Avraham is a Baal Chesed. So if the Medrash tells us that Avraham was like the greatest Baal Chesed of all, it's not just made out of thin air. Even as we have a few psukim that tell us that he did a chesed, but the Torah itself, by saying Elonei Mamre and referencing the eights multiple times in connection with Avraham Avinu, is I think reinforcing this point of chesed. So Avraham Avinu indicates through that what it means to have this covenant with Hashem. Is, yes, it is a transition, it is a significant change, but that change is one which opens the doors for a life of generosity, of kindness, of openness to others. That is chesed, of breaking down the boundaries with other people. So at the same time that he is doing this mitzvah of bris milah, which sets him apart, he is simultaneously more engaged in chesed than ever before, and breaking down the boundaries with others. Right. So the purpose of the covenant is not to set him apart and be away from people. The purpose of the covenant is to enable greater chesed with other people, and that is the Elonei Mamre. This is a change. This is a transition. It is a significant moment of Jewish history. It represents that the trajectory of Avraham and what it means to be an Eved Hashem is Chesed. That's why you have Chesed here in the beginning, Chesed in the middle, and Chesed at the end. Yukachna ma'at ma'imra chatzurag lechem v'hishanu tachas ha'etz. Why tachas ha'etz? It's an unnecessary factoid. It's an unnecessary detail. It is, what's the word?
Superfluous.
Yeah, it's superfluous. What are they? What's the word when they say like in a movie where they have too much like unnecessary violence? It's there just for you know.
Why?
What's the word I'm looking for? Okay, it's like superfluous. It's not necessary, right? So you could say yukachna ma'at ma'im v'chatzur aglechem v'shanu and rest. Why tachas ha'etz? Because this eitz represents everything there is to know about what it means to be an Eved Hashem. Right? And here too, Avraham perhaps, right, is trying to spread the word, as it were. To spread the word of Hashem. Hishanu tachas ha'etz. Understand that this is what it means to have an acknowledgement of Hashem and let Hashem guide you in your life. Right? And then at the end over here, Vela Bakarat Avraham, Vaikachema, Vahu Omeid Alehem Tachas Ha'etz. And he is standing and doting and waiting upon them under the tree.
That's the opposite, Rabbi, of how it started when it said the Malachim Nitzavim Alav.
Yes, right. That
and
is good. That is
like
right. So this is the power of the eights. This is the power of what the eights represents. When you transition into being, you know, an Avramite, an Abrahamic Jew, right? Somebody who is guided by Dvar Hashem, then you do. It's more chesed. It's not less chesed, Right? They came, they were standing over him, and now he is standing over them to wait, to help them, to wait upon them. But I think that the biggest, or the most significant, one of the most significant things here is that the presence of the aphid. Remember, we said that the aphid is uniquely present in this tree, and it lays its eggs and it destroys the tree. And so while externally it looks like the tree is being destroyed, it actually is protecting and defending the tree. Right? And this is what Avraham is personifying here. When Avraham does the Bris Milah, it looks like it's self-immolation. It looks like it's self-mutilation, excuse me. It looks like he's harming himself. And he's harming himself in a very delicate, portion of his body, which is all about procreation, right? So if he harms himself here, he is basically cutting off his ability to, be fruitful and multiply. So it seems, it looks on the one hand like the aphid destroying the leaf, but it's not true. Only on the external level does it seem that it is somehow destructive. But what seems to be destructive, and on some level is, they are destroying the leaves, right? He is performing minor surgery upon himself. And maybe in days of old, this was major surgery. So it's not nothing. It's not just a mirage that it appears to be harmful. It is harmful. But it is not truly harmful. It is something that might on one level be harmful, but on a bigger level, a great defense and support. And that's what the Bris Milah looks like. And that really is sort of the message that Avraham, I think, is sending, right, to all the people that are willing to hear. And that is that, a life, to use sort of later terminology of Torah and mitzvos, but a life of Torah and mitzvos might seem limiting. It might sometimes even appear to be not resonant with my views and my culture and my approach to life, and it might even seem backward. It might even seem harmful on some level. But that's all, when we think about putting limits upon myself and putting things which seem, these are limits that actually enable a person to soar. And that's what the metaphor, I think, of the Elon is. That's the metaphor of the terebinth tree and why it's present here. Because it encapsulates what Avraham did with the Bris Milah. And it encapsulates the ethos of what it means to be an Eved Hashem, especially this last point. It might seem limiting, it might seem quote-unquote harmful on some level, but actually a life of Torah and mitzvos is one in which enables the person to to truly soar and to truly be free and to truly and ultimately who they are in the deepest and most profound way. And that's the greatest sense of liberty that a person can achieve. So if our opening question was, what's the, why is, that's the first thing that Judy said. The story seems that it could read even without telling us that it was an Elone Mamre. Okay, Rashi tells us one thing, the Ramban says something else, but I think with our understanding of the nature of what this tree is and identifying what this tree is, and then understanding the nature of this tree, I think that we can give a different perspective as to why it is significant that that the tree is present in this very, very critical story, a foundational story of Avraham and the Jewish people. And then, based on this, now it makes sense that the very next story is really about the promise of a child and going to down. And Avraham and Lot and Sodom being destroyed. This is the foundation of it all. Things sometimes seem that they're negative; they're really positive. Sometimes that they're challenging; they're really part of a greater plan. ultimately, when ultimately, and with this I conclude, the advice of Mamre, as Rav Moshe Feinstein understood it, I think is the right advice. Avraham said to himself, maybe I should do this in private, because maybe it's going to turn people away. And Mamre said, no, when you're doing a mitzvah stands on its own, and there's nothing to be afraid of. There's nothing to be concerned about. People will either take the message or they won't take the message, but you don't have to be afraid of it. So that itself is what goes on here. The bris milah, right? That's what the terebinth tree is. It looks like on one level that the aphids are damaging the tree, right? So get rid of all the bugs. Get rid of the bugs. No, you get rid of the bugs and the tree dies. So with that, we conclude today. And if anybody has any other comments or questions before we head off, I'm happy to hear it. Thank you. Go ahead, Barbara.
What an interesting shiur, Rabbi.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. All right. Anybody else? Any other comments? Or
I just have a quick question. Yeah. I was just wondering, you said that the Torah mitzvahs aren't limiting, but they're what? I didn't get what...